podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 180,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookhype. Hey everyone, I'm Jen, and today I'm joined by Karen, Brittany, and Kristen. We're going for a big show today, everyone. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Pretty good.
Ooh, party.
I feel like you need noisemakers the next time you do that. So today we are going to discuss Magnus Chase and the Swords of Summer.
Yes.
And like, it's an absurdly long title. It's like Magnus Chase
and the Gods of Asgard,
the Sword of Summer, book one. So we'll be discussing that today. And that was Karen's little yes you heard in there. Sure. She was adamant that all of us had to be on. We've all read it. And she's like, no, we have all of you on. So we're all here. Party on. All right. But first, before we get to the conversation, let's see what everyone's been reading lately. I have to say I've been slacking because I have an exam to study for. It's my certification exam, and it's kind of big and large. So I've been reading nothing fun. I'm not going to lie. It's been really like study stuff and true facts. I may be a teacher, but I hate to study, so it's been very painful, and I haven't been able to read a lot. But you guys look like you've been reading a lot, so let's talk about what you've been reading. So, Miss Karen, why don't you go ahead and kick it off for us?
Okay. I read Sweet Madness by Tricia Lever, which is a story about, oh my God, what's her name? Lizzie Borden. It's about Lizzie Borden, and it's told from the point of view of her maid. And so it kind of gives you this look into, well, was Lizzie Borden really crazy, or was she driven to what she did? And it was a pretty good book. I wish there was more, like, violence and bloodshed and not just at the end, which is really terrible. But I was
kind of,
I know. I'm a little concerned. I was expecting it to be a little bit darker than it was. And it wasn't, so it just left a little lacking for me. But other than that, it was pretty good. However, Daughters Unto Devils by Amy Lukovics definitely was perfect because that was a freaking scary book, like probably the scariest I've read so far. It's about this family who moves out to the prairie. It's like, I don't know, I think it's set back in the 1800s or something. And they find this cottage and there's like dead bodies inside, and the father's like, no, it's fine, we'll just clean it up and everything will be perfect and you will be happy because I told you to be happy, damn it. And he just sort of like starts getting a little nuts, and then the whole family starts getting affected by this area that I guess is haunted. They don't really say exactly what happened, just that the land there is not right, and it gets pretty creepy, and there are some, like, dead children apparitions, which are the worst. They're the absolute scariest for me, so that was bad, and I try not to read too much of it at night, because last time that did not go well for me, but it was really good. And then I read Romancing the Dark in the City of Light by Anne Jacobus, and that was very, very good. I wish I could have read it slower than I had to because I kind of had to fly through it, but I want to reread it because it was so good. It's about this girl who moves to Paris and she's been kicked out of her boarding schools, and this is like she has this inheritance that she's going to get, but only if she graduates from high school and graduates from a four-year university by the time she's 22. And she's not a great kid. She struggles with school. She drinks a lot and she is suicidal. And so she has to think very hard about, okay, do I want this inheritance? Am I doing this for me? Do I want to even be here anymore? And she meets these two guys and they pull her in opposite directions. But there's a good twist to the story and there's a lot of really deep kind of stuff in there, for lack of a better word, to draw you in and to kind of explain how exactly somebody in her situation feels Very good. Highly recommended for, like, everybody. I thought it was awesome. And then I finished today, Wendy Darling by Colleen Oakes. I've talked about her before. She wrote the Red Queen series that I've liked a lot. And this is the first book in her new series. And it's about Peter Pan, except Peter Pan's not a nice dude. And I was talking to Kristen earlier today about how he, like, is kind of abusive, and I'm pretty sure Tinkerbell has, like, Stockholm Syndrome, and it's just nuts. So that was fun, but definitely an interesting twist on the story.
Awesome. You've been up to a lot of reading. I like it. All right. How about you, Miss Kristen? You always read so, like, such different books than we read, so I can't wait to see what you've been up to.
Oh, yeah, lots and lots of fun. Casey Quinn just released the last book in the Neon Dreams series called Missing Dixie, which is more of a continuation from the first book. Like, it's kind of the first book and the last book are basically the same two characters' story. And so a lot of people have been very anxious to read it. I polished it off in like 4 hours because, yeah, it was that good. Loved it very much. I recommend it to anybody. I'm currently reading The Game Plan by Kristen Callahan, and I am almost done with it, and it's so good. It's actually the third book in her series. It's kind of like the series starts in with these characters in college, and it kind of surrounds this group of friends that all are all football players. And the third book is post college, and they're all in their careers. Like, the three best friends at the core of it are all playing in the NFL, and so you kind of see how they have separated to their different teams and how their lives are affected by that. But the story is really that of Dexter and Ethan Dexter and this girl, Fiona McKenzie. And you kind of know both characters from the previous books. So I'm loving it. And it just got to the really good part, like right before we started recording. So I was trying to sneak in every word I could before we started. but, you know, I'll have to get back to that in, you know, an hour or so. I just also started Leveled by Jay Crownover. It was released last night at midnight, and I want to dive in so badly. It's killing me. Leveled kind of bridges the gap between the Marked Men series that is Jay's pride and joy. Like, that's the series that kind of landed her in the romance scene. And her new series, The Saints of Denver, which takes place in the same city in Denver as Marked Men, but it kind of bridges the worlds. And so you see a lot of characters from the Marked Men series, and you'll meet some new ones that are going to be in the Saints of Denver. It's supposed to be really great. It's about these two guys. It's Orlando and Dom, and I am so geeked about it because they both have really, really intricate histories with all the characters in the first series. So I'm really excited to dive into that. I started it just so that I could say I've started it, but I have a long way to go. And lastly, I had to. I mean, come on. And lastly, I love, 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 love Lauren Lane. And she put out this standalone. She has a couple of series that she's been working on, but she put out this standalone called Blurred Lines that is seriously one of my favorite books I have read in the last like 4 years. Like, it's about a guy and a girl who are absolute best friends and who have, you know, they've played with that line of we could be more and just kind of went, no, there's no way. And in this book, like, somehow that line gets blurred again for them, but it's done so well. I've read the whole best friends to lovers thing before, and it sometimes can be a little hokey, but she wrote a really beautiful story, and I highly recommend that one if anybody's into that, like, trope. She does a really good job of it, but yeah, so lots and lots of reading.
All right, and Brittany, what have you been up to?
Well, after the most stressful reading experience of my life, I went back.
What was stressful? What?
Reading a Rick Riordan book for the first time and having Karen feeling like Karen is just sitting in a room somewhere watching me in a crystal ball.
Been there.
Karen's been there. The nice one. Like,
okay. I'm also the intense one, so I understand.
Okay, I don't think I've
wake up and
I
have like a text message and a Facebook message. Have you read it? You haven't been updating me. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. But yeah, so after that, I cracked open my Harry Potter Illustrated Edition, and it was gorgeous and very relaxing and fun to look at. And then all the Harry Potter news kind of happened when I was reading that, so it was like really intense. But then I read the Welcome to Night Vale novel, and it was good. I definitely like the podcast better. I'm realizing I like to listen to things a lot, because now that I've started like really commuting regularly, I listen to podcasts every morning. So when I'm reading, I'm kind of like, eh. So, yeah, but it's good. It's, about, so there's like this guy, Jackie, who lives in, he lives obviously in Night Vale, but there's like, you know, Night Vale is very mysterious, and like he keeps getting like this paper that has something about like King City on it. And so, you know, there's the man in the tan jacket, and then, you know, it's really good. It's, if you love the podcast, you'll love the book. You could fly right through it. It's only 400 pages. It's an easy read. And then I keep staring at Carry On, because I got my Carry On like little fun packet from the publisher, which is cool. And yeah, that's pretty much all I've been reading. But if you want to listen to books like I've been doing, and you're obsessed with Hamilton like I am and Karen is, then I poked Karen the other day, and I was like, hey, I know our book to consider for Audible, and it's Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, read by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is the star and creator of Hamilton. You should definitely check it out. It's about two friends who kind of have to deal with the possibility that they may like each other more than friends. And it's really, really good. And I think that I might go back and actually listen to it just because of Lynn. And if you want to listen to it, you can download it at audiblepodcast.com/bookhype. audiblepodcast.com/bookhype. Go get it. Listen to Lynn. Then listen to Hamilton. And then listen to Lynn read other things.
And then listen to us.
And then listen to us talk about Lynn reading things.
All right, then. Now that's it. And now I'm curious. Now I'm going to have to go listen to it. We'll see. We'll see. All right. So now we're going to get over to Karen's favorite part of the podcast, where we talk all about Magnus Chase and Rick Riordan. First, I guess we're going to start with if it's a buy or a borrow. And Karen, why don't you go ahead and, you know, state your opinion, get it out of the way.
I mean, buy. There's no other option.
Like that was even a question. Kristen?
Definitely a buy, unless you're going to wait for a box set, and then it's okay to borrow, but it's definitely worth the buy.
Okay, and Brittany?
Okay, I'm going to borrow.
Oh, boy. I knew by that okay it was going to be trouble. Continue.
But only because, I feel like I'm going to have to drop a lot of money to read all of his other books, so I'm going to borrow as much as I can in order to save money.
Oh, interesting tact you're taking. I see, I see.
I thought about this.
It's just like I had to
throw her off her game, just right. Throw Karen off and then come back and, you know, support it.
I'm going to say bye. I actually really, really liked this book. I was surprised. It surprised me in a lot of ways. All right. So let's get right on to it, because I think there's a lot going on in this book. It's kind of a large book. What it's over 400 pages, right? 500 pages? How many pages?
Yeah.
Over 400.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, I have it here. Oh, no, it's actually almost 500 pages. It's 497 pages. So it's a big book. Anyway, so let's talk about it a little bit. So this is Rick Riordan's new series. It is about Magnus Chase. So we don't really see anyone from the Percy Jackson world except for one person who shows briefly in the beginning and then briefly in the end, and that is Annabeth. And Annabeth's last name just happens to be Chase, so therefore Annabeth and Magnus are cousins. And she plays a very, very, very small role within this novel. We see her at the very beginning, and then we see her again at the very, very end. And it's kind of cool how he interweaves Annabeth and Magnus a little bit. And basically the whole idea of the plot is Magnus is turning 16, and on his 16th birthday, there are people looking for him who happen to be Annabeth and her dad, because they didn't know that Magnus is homeless. He's living on the streets. 2 years prior, his mom was killed. And as far as Magnus knows, he saw these wolves come for his mom and that his mom was killed. And there was a fire at their apartment. And so he didn't trust his uncle, Randolph. So instead of going to him, and Uncle Randolph lives on, like, in Back Bay. And if you guys are from the Boston area, you know Back Bay is a fairly wealthy, affluent area. But Magnus doesn't go to his uncle because he doesn't trust him. So Magnus chooses to live on the streets and be homeless. So on his 16th birthday, there are people coming to look for Magnus, other than Annabeth and her dad. And so Magnus essentially dies on his 16th birthday. This is not a shocking thing. This happens within the first two chapters of the book. In fact, the chapter titles give it away. And so Magnus dies, but he is taken to Valhalla, which, for any of you guys know any Norse mythology, that's the Norse afterlife. And he's taken to Valhalla, and he finds out that his destiny in some way is to stop Ragnarok, which is the kind of apocalypse in Norse mythology. So Magnus is special in a way, but Magnus has no idea how he is special. And he doesn't know who his Norse parent is. It's his father. But he doesn't know who his Norse father is until much later. The story really kind of takes off with Magnus living in Boston, being homeless, and these two characters that are around that kind of help him and try to steer him through. One of them's name is Hearth, and he's a deaf character, which is kind of really cool to have in a YA novel. You don't really get a lot of that. So I liked having him as a character within the story. And then the other one is Blitz, or Blitzen, and he is... also a homeless person, per se, for now. We're going to stick with that story, that works with Magnus and helps Magnus. Later on, we find out that they're not exactly who we thought that they were. So what did you guys think about the overall idea of Magnus living in Boston, being homeless, the introduction of a deaf character? We also have a lot of culturally diverse characters within the story. When we talk about the characters later, we have Sam, who is basically, she's a Valkyrie, and she works with Magnus. She's actually the person that brings Magnus to Valhalla. So what did you guys think about the diverseness of characters within the story?
Well, I mean, just to throw it out there up front, like, I think Magnus Chase already rivals Percy Jackson. I really, really liked this book, and I think a huge part of it is that it's a little more grown up and it's a little darker. I think the fact that he chose a homeless boy as his hero was huge, and it shows that anybody can be homeless and the homeless can be anybody. Like, they are not just things to ignore on the street. A lot of them have stories and reasons why they're there, and they're good people with, you know, bad things that happen to them. And I think that kids reading these books will see that and we'll have a better appreciation for other types of people, especially people like Sam, who is Arab American and she's traditional and she wears traditional clothing and has a lot of the traditional religious, observes right. A lot of traditions in her culture and her religion. And I think people like that these days are still looked down upon. And the fact that he decided to make her one of the heroes in his stories is going to be huge for kids. So, and I think for teenagers and adults who are going to read these books too. And I think he did a lot to diversify this story. And I just think it makes it that much stronger because of it.
I agree. Does anyone have any other thoughts on the diversity within the story?
I was just glad that they did. It was very diverse because, you know, you're coming into this story that has, like, you know, you're dealing with 9 worlds, and you can really have a million different types of people that are, and half people and giants and everything like that that's going on. You have people from, as we see in a little bit, like from the Civil War era and like all this stuff that's going on at the same time. So to make the main cast in the present day diverse is just, it makes sense, and more books should be like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, especially after the Percy Jackson books that are pretty diverse themselves, and you're coming with, you're bringing a group of characters that all have some sort of bloodline in common, to even be able to make those as diverse as he does, it just makes it even that much more, like, rich and real. Like, I feel like that helps these stories be that much more intriguing. And so, yeah, no, I loved Sam. I'm really, really glad that she and Magnus, like, don't seem to be a thing, and that makes me really, really happy too. So we'll see.
Yeah, I really like that aspect of the story. I think it's great when an author like Rick Riordan, who has so many readers, tries to touch upon so many different aspects of character, because it just broadens his reader base. It connects with his reader base so much more, because he can identify with all those different people in a lot of ways, which I think is super cool. So, like I said, the writing style, I don't know if I would classify this as a middle grade book. Like, Percy Jackson is definitely a middle grade book. It starts when Percy is 12. This starts when Magnus is 16. So to me, this feels much more like a young adult book. Do you guys think that,
I agree with you. I think it feels a lot older, but I did look it up, and both Amazon and like the New York Times bestselling list treat it like a children's book. They call it a children's book.
Are you serious? No, yeah. No way.
Yes, they do. I clearly looked it up.
No, I'm not saying no way to you. I'm saying no way. Like, did they read the book? Did they pick it up?
And actually, it's like, open it pages? Gets a little dark sometimes.
Well, it's dark, and the characters are older, because Percy is 16 and Samira, or Sam, is 16, but Blitzen and Hearth are older. Percy is surrounded by older people for the most part, other than Sam. Do you know what I mean? Like, so that's,
and it's very violent. It's very descriptive.
And it's just,
yes. And they're all dead. Like, half of the characters in this book are dead.
Yes, but then Valhalla, it's different.
I know. But still, like, that's not a, like, lighthearted, that's not something I would think of having in a children's book. So, yeah, that's surprising.
I'm really surprised by that, because it reads much older, and I enjoyed it. Like, I enjoy that it reads older, and I like that Magnus is 16. It's just a different take on things, and it has more serious things, like homelessness and death and how you kind of, all those different things. So I don't know. I don't know about that dear New York Times bestselling list, but you know, he is a New York Times bestseller, so who are we to complain? And then the book is super humorous. Did you guys like the humor within the book?
Oh my God. I love Hearth and his sense of humor. Like, him signing things and people like misinterpreting them, especially Thor. Who is basically Hercules, let's be real. But like that whole scene, just, oh my God, I love Hearth so much. But yeah, no, the humor in general is great. It's kind of a little bit older humor, which I liked, because I mean, even in Percy, there's a lot of laughs, but you get them at the expense of like the wit. Whereas I think you get a lot more of Rick's wit in this book.
Yeah, I definitely felt like when I was reading the book, like I was sitting, if you guys have ever been to one of his like presentations, because his is not like, when you go to an event for him, it is literally, there's a PowerPoint presentation, or at least the one that I went to, there was. And so he's definitely a teacher. There's this element to him, because that's what he started out as. He started out as a teacher, and now he's a multimillionaire author. So go figure. I don't know how that works. If anyone knows the secret to that, let me know. So, but he goes and does all these things, and so he's, like, when he's on, he's super funny, and you could definitely, like, get some of his humor through the story he's telling, and I liked a lot of, like, the current references, like, to Taylor Swift, and, like, I'm pretty sure there was a Doctor Who reference in there, and, like, so it was really cool to have these references thrown in, and to have it kind of be hip and young, and very on point and current.
Well, this was my only complaint about the book. I thought, and so let me preface this by saying I think I would have enjoyed this book so much better had I listened to it rather than read it, because I'm not used to reading Rick Riordan, so I didn't really know what I was getting into, but it was like punchline after punchline after punchline, and I was like, okay, this is going to be really exhausting, and the humor is not going to be funny anymore. But once I got through the first couple of chapters, and I really just sat down one afternoon and finished the book, it was easier to read instead of just focusing on like, oh, here's another joke, oh, here's another joke. And then I started like counting sentences, like how many sentences have we gone without a joke or a reference to something? So that was my own brain being mean. But yeah, I still think I would have enjoyed it a lot more had I listened to it, because I would have just laughed and moved on, sort of like the Martian humor.
I think that's a fair complaint, because he's written, especially Percy Jackson in particular, for kids, boys especially, who maybe not, you know, didn't want to really read, who have ADD and ADHD and who can't focus and need punchline after punchline. So I think knowing that going into it kind of makes it a little bit easier to handle. But considering you haven't read any of his other books, and I did tell Brittany, like, the Percy Jackson books are probably worse, because they're the humor is a lot more childish, and there are a lot more, like, just stupid jokes. Some of them I don't even find funny, but I really liked the humor in this one, and I thought it was a bit more grown up, and just the references really got me. And I just love the way that he can incorporate them and how he talked about, like the Marvel movies and stuff like that, because you knew he had to make a reference to that at some point. And it was so satisfying sitting in my room and hearing Kristen laugh across the hallway in her bedroom. They're like, what part did you just get to? And she'd explain, oh, yeah, that was really good. 5 minutes later, she'd be laughing again. It was great.
Let's just say basically whenever he's in battle with his little buddies from Valhalla, I am dying. Like, I laughed throughout all of those sequences. Anyway.
I would just like to say whenever Jack speaks is when I'm like,
yeah,
where can I get one? Because please, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know, Jack is the name of the sword. he kind of named himself because he wanted a name, and Summer Brander, which is his actual name, was too difficult to say all the time. So he got a cool name, and he decided he was going to be Jack. Anyway, so I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I like the mythology vibe to it. I like what they did with some of the characters. When we get to it and we talk about Thor, yeah, let's get there soon. But before we get to that, let's talk about setting. So what did you guys think of Boston as the backdrop? Not that we spent a lot of time in Boston, but what did you guys think about Boston as the backdrop for Magnus's story?
It was so weird. Like, thinking about all of these things, like the ducks being the portals to the Nine Worlds, I was like, I've taken pictures with those ducks. I've seen them in their Santa hats. I've run across that park. I've been to the Cheers bar. I'm like, this is so weird. But I like the way that he explained it. It made sense in a way that I was like, okay, I see where you're coming from. Like, you know, there's a lot to work with there, and like how they, like, you know, New England was always like this, like something was always up, you know, in this part of the world. And it was interesting. I don't know if Boston is the hub of the Nine Worlds. I don't know if I'd go that far, but it made sense. And it was kind of cool, especially since I've been there a couple times. So I kind of could picture what they were doing and where they were.
All right. Kristen and Karen, what do you guys think?
I've never been to Boston, so like,
yes,
yeah, really? I know, I'm sorry. I've never been to Boston, so I don't really have a frame of reference. Like, I know what I know about, you know, Boston's history from, you know, American history in high school, and I know, you know, more recent history, like the Boston Marathon and the bombing and all that stuff. So like, there are things I know about Boston, but I don't really know the city very well. So for me, it was just, you know, an older city that has a lot of history, and just getting to know it in that way was interesting, but it didn't really like stand out for me.
Did he blame the Boston bombing on the gods?
No.
In this book?
No.
I don't think so.
I thought that he was like, they're still, there was a part where he was like, they're still trying to figure out that something, I don't know. Maybe I read that wrong, but I was like, huh.
No, I don't, I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Oh, the Boston explosions, meaning the bridge attack.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that part, I was like, whoa, that's not cool. But then now that makes more sense. I just found, for some reason, I actually randomly opened up to the correct page, which was really convenient. So I was like, oh, Great Chicago Fire. Yeah, okay.
I'm on the gods page, were actually. Like, no, don't blame that on us. Here's your proof. Yes.
All right.
I kind of fall a little bit in between because I've been to Boston twice, but it was only to go to the airport. And my most recent trip there, Jen drove me. And as we were driving into the city, she was like, tell me the places that are in the book. And I started naming off a couple. And she's like, oh, that's over there and that's over there. And it was cool to actually see it, having read the book first and not really being able to picture it. I like the fact that it was in Boston. I think that one of the greatest things about his books is that he can take these really familiar places, like in Percy Jackson, New York City is the hub of the Greek world, and Olympus sits atop the Empire State Building. And for him to turn another city into another hub of mythology just falls in line with how his other worlds work. And I always really appreciate that. And because I don't know Boston that well, it was nice to get a glimpse into something new. I was actually a little disappointed that we didn't spend quite as much time there. While the nine worlds were really interesting, I just like when he mixes up what we see in real life and can kind of explain certain things according to the mythologies. And it would have been nice to see a bit more of that, I think.
Yeah, I think he did a really good job hitting on some of the really big key places in Boston. I lived in Boston for quite a while, so I was like, oh, yeah, no, he definitely hit on a lot of things that not everyone would hit on. And he lives in the Boston area now, so like, research for him is like, oh, I'm going to go take a walk down the street or, you know, stroll to this place to see what it looks like and make sure I have the details. And he definitely has the details. And I think one of my favorite parts is when he's talking about where his uncle lives and he can look outside the window and see the statue of Leif Erikson. There is legitimately a statue of Leif Erikson randomly at the beginning of the Public Garden in Boston. And there's a lot of, like, historical, like, not evidence, because there isn't really a lot of evidence, but like there are a few professors who worked at Harvard and such that definitely felt like the Vikings had been there before the Pilgrims. And so there was a lot of research done around that. And so there's a lot of like lore in Boston about the Vikings being there at some point. So it's really interesting to have these kind of random things that he infuses the story with to make them all that more like, it makes you think about it. It makes you wonder why. And I love that the ducks were the portals. And later on, when Blitzen is in a competition, he gets really nervous. And the first thing he builds is an expandable duck. And I love that. It was great. So I thought that part was super fun. And I liked the way he kind of adapted those places and things to make them different. So let's talk some more about character, because we haven't like fully kind of gone there with the characters. There's a lot going on. So Magnus, as we discussed, is 16. He is initially homeless. Originally he just lived with his mom, Natalie, who was killed. And Magnus chose to live on the streets, and on the streets he meets these two, men who kind of look after him, or they're not men, they're young men. They're not as young as Magnus, but they're like in their early 20s, would you guys say? That'd be your guess if you had to guess.
I always pictured them a bit older, but that could be me just making that up in my head.
Right. I mean, it's not very specific. It's kind of hard. I don't know. It was hard to decipher how old they were, but they're older than Magnus. One of them is Hearth, and he is actually an elf. And he is deaf, and so he uses ALS to communicate with both Magnus and Blitzen, and Blitzen is a dwarf, but at the time, Magnus has no idea. He thinks that they're both human. So what did you guys think of Magnus as a character and how he kind of approaches his new fate?
He was very frank about it. I think that he accepted it fairly quickly, which I think was necessary to kind of go along with the plot. So I don't, you know, take anything away from that. I think it was fine. I liked his practicality, which I think came from living on the streets for a couple of years. His humor was really dark, which, like we've said, I really appreciated that, especially compared to the ridiculous humor of Percy Jackson. And I will say him as a narrator rivals Percy in my mind, just because while I really love Percy and I'm always going to love Percy, there's just something about Magnus that feels a little bit more relatable. He's had to work a lot harder for everything that he's done, and he really started at the bottom. Not to say that Percy didn't have a lot of crap happen to him before he went to Camp Half-Blood and everything, but Magnus was really at the bottom rung, and he worked his way up to become a hero, and I really appreciated that he didn't let it get him down. I mean, sometimes he did, but he worked through it regardless.
Yeah, I mean, I can't compare it to Percy Jackson, because all I know about Percy Jackson is that Stanley Tucci's in the movie, and literally that's where my knowledge ends. Because one day it was on, and I was like, oh, it's Stanley Tucci. Okay, moving on. But yeah, I loved his, when he's left alone when he first gets to Valhalla, because he's sort of he's angry, and he flips the couch, and he's like, well, that's not going to make any difference. He's like, all I'm doing is making more work for people. I'm just going to have to suck it up and figure this out. And there's really no way of getting around anything that he has to do. So he goes and he fights the next morning. He kind of takes it in stride, but he is able to keep a little bit of himself through all of it without getting too dark. But I really liked him as a character because he didn't change too much from beginning to end, which was good. He didn't let it go to his head, but he also didn't try to fight it for too long. But it was nice to have those human moments, if you will.
Yeah, one of my biggest complaints about Percy, which, I mean, I love Percy, and he is a younger character, which is something to keep in mind, especially when you first meet him. I liked that Magnus isn't as naive as Percy is. When you read the Percy Jackson novels, he kind of just buys in to just about everything and believes people for things that he should never have even thought. You as a reader know that he's in trouble before he has any clue. Whereas with Magnus, he's not as naive. He wants to, he knows the street. He knows people. He's been around different types. The thing that pops in my head the most is the whole bag lady thing when he meets, the river spirit, who I cannot think of the name of right now.
Rand.
Rand, thank you. When he meets Rand, he immediately puts it together and is he knows how to handle this. And I really enjoyed that aspect of Magnus. He's an experienced guy. He knows what's going on and he can get himself out of trouble.
He kind of reminds me a little bit the whole street rat in Aladdin, kind of that whole idea about it. I really think that that's kind of he's got street smarts. He's learned some hard lessons and he's moving on from there. So I definitely agree with you. All right. So now let's talk about Samira Al Abbas. And Samira she's a Valkyrie, which means she chooses the people that go to Valhalla. And those who get chosen are supposed to be chosen upon bravery, and they have to die with a weapon in their hand. You guys can't see my air quotes for weapon, but it was there. they have to die with a weapon in their hand. And they have to be brave and sort of selfless and those kinds of things. And Samira is, I guess we're going to throw her parentage right on out there. Samira is the daughter of Loki. And I love this aspect about her whole character because it's so different from who Samira is. So when you find out who her father is, you're like, what? But it's it makes her character all that much cooler. I loved it. So Samira is Loki's daughter, but she was brought in to be a Valkyrie by Odin, which is almost unheard of. So she comes in as a Valkyrie, and the other Valkyries are not very nice to Samira. And while Samira is, like Karen said, she's traditional, she wears a hijab, while, in our world, being who she is difficult enough and challenging enough. People, you know, say really mean things to her and question her religion and her faith and things like that. As part being part of the Valkyries, that part doesn't matter so much. But what matters is that she is Loki's daughter. So Samira faces a lot of prejudice on all ends, no matter where she is. And I loved her character. I love that she was a strong female. I love that she was so diverse and so traditional. There was just a lot about Samira I really liked. And I liked how she stands up to Percy. Stands up to Magnus. She's not afraid to kind of put him in his place when she needs to, but she's also listen to him when that's important too. So I think that Magnus and Sam kind of balance each other in a really good way. So what did you guys think about Sam?
I was going to say, I really like her character. You don't know what's going on with her for quite a long time. And I kept wanting to know more and more and more about her. Like, we find out like little things here and there, but you don't really know like who told her things and like what her relationship with Loki is kind of like for a really long time. And I know very little about a lot of this stuff. So I'm like, oh, Loki, let me Google Loki, because all I know is Tom Hiddleston.
Like, and sometimes really that's enough. My
element here. Like, I've seen Thor, but so I knew the Frost Giants guys. Let me tell you how excited I was that I knew who the Frost Giants were. I was like, I know them. So I really liked her character, and I thought that she had a really interesting personality, and no one was really put off by her, which I really appreciated. Like, no one was like, oh, God, Sam, just shut up. Like, she was just like, they were like, all right, Sam, like, that's how you are. We're going to let you be you. So I liked her.
Yeah, Sam, like, talk about having all of the cards stacked against you. She has to live a life as somebody who, you know, she's a minority, and being Arab American is hard enough. But on top of that, she has to live this double life of being a Valkyrie. And on top of that, she's Loki's daughter, which definitely has some negative connotations to it. And yet she takes it all in stride. And she's like, you know, she lives with her grandparents and she still has to try to get all of her homework done. And she doesn't really make excuses. She just buckles down and gets it done. And sometimes it's hard and sometimes it gets to her, but she knows the job she has to do and she's going to do it anyway and to the best of her ability. And that alone, I think, just cemented her as one of my favorite characters, because you don't see that a whole lot. She didn't make excuses for herself. She just did it. And even though she had to live with all of that prejudice, she just tried her hardest to be the best person she could be.
And I guess one thing we forgot to mention about Samira is that she is in an arranged marriage at 16. Like, she, and the best part is that at one point in the story, Magnus decides they've left Valhalla and they're going to go, they're hungry, so they're going to get food. And so he goes to this falafel place that he knows, and the family there, the Fedlon family, is very nice to him, and they always give him the day-old stuff. The stuff that they can't sell but is still edible, they always give it to Magnus, and they always help him out. And in return, Magnus makes sure that the homeless people that are there are respectful and clean up after themselves. And this is at the transportation place. So come to find out, the people that are really, really nice to Magnus and help take care of him are the family that Sam is betrothed to, essentially. And so the son Amir is who Sam is betrothed to, and he happens to know Magnus really, really well. So that's a really funny moment when you see something's wrong with Sam. Sam's typically normally very confident and very comfortable with who she is, but when they're going to this place, she doesn't want to admit what's going on, and she won't tell Magnus. And so Magnus right away knows that there's something going on and that they know each other, and he thinks it's really strange. And so later Sam kind of has to own the fact that she is betrothed to Amir, which was kind of an interesting conversation, the way she presented it and talked about it.
Especially the fact that she wants to be betrothed to him. Like, when have you ever read a story like that? when she's like, actually, they, you know, want to make sure that I'm happy with the person that I have to get married to. And I am. She really likes the guy. And I was like pumping my fist as I was reading that part because it was so good and such a positive spin on something that I think a lot of Americans feel very weirdly about.
Yeah, I think it's something that people are terrified of because they don't necessarily understand it. And I love that here it makes it easy to understand. Like, she clearly, you know, lays it out for Magnus. She's like, I like the guy. I'm betrothed to him. It's not weird. It's my culture. That's how we do things. And it was just like, okay, cool. We're done. Moving on. Like, I really love Sam, and I love how she treated that whole situation. Like, she made it really easy to understand, really easy to get that it's not weird for her. It's not something she's dreading. Like, you see so many characters struggle with it, you know, especially with Arab American characters. Like, they always struggle with that kind of thing. And it's nice to see that it's not something she's worried about. It's just a thing that's out there that is eventually going to be a part of her life.
Exactly. And I really love that about the story. It made it normalized in a lot of ways. So that was really cool. All right. So we all agree we kind of love Sam. Moving on, we have Hearth and Blitzen. And together, can I just tell you guys how much I love these two? They're like sidekicks and they're a lot of fun. And I love that Blitzen. Okay. Blitzen is a dwarf, and dwarfs are meant to make things that last. And when we see a little glimpse of the dwarf world, it's one of the nine realms. And they talk about, you know, how when you go to sit in a chair and it's like, you may sit in this chair and so-and-so made this chair and this is how old it is. And it kind of gives you this whole history behind the chair, because when dwarves make things, they make things that last. The idea is that they'll last a lifetime. And Blitzen likes to make things, but his things aren't furniture or things that are really have a lot of function to them. Blitzen really likes fashion. Did you guys get a Tim Gunn vibe? Anyone? No?
I mean, who doesn't love Tim Gunn?
But there was elements of that for him. I was just like, oh, I could see it. So what did you guys think about... And I loved Hearth, because Hearth is super sassy and he practices rune magic, but everything he says he has to do through ALS, which is fantastic because everyone misinterprets him. Thor especially, because Thor in this story is kind of ridiculous, but we'll get to that. So what do you guys think about the two of them together as characters?
I love Hearth and Blitzen. Like, it's just that simple. I think they're great companions for Magnus, who's not necessarily like a believer. Like, he's been homeless, he's been on the street, so he's kind of, you know, he's a little bit skeptical about things sometimes. And you've got Blitz and Hearth, who know just about everything. Like, I mean, they, between the two of them, have a really good understanding of what they're coming up against, and they're there for him. They've been there for him before he even knew who they really were. And now that Magnus knows that Hearth is an elf and Blitz is a dwarf, like, they're still there for him. And I love them. They're hilarious. As I said before, Hearth just has me dying. Like, I love it. I'm definitely on board for more Hearth and Blitzen, that's for sure.
Yeah, I guess it's important to note too that Hearth and Blitzen were specifically sent to watch after Magnus once his mom died. And they were sent to watch over Magnus by someone called Mimir. And Mimir is literally a head. He was a god that was decapitated. And so he now, like, lives in a well. And if you drink from his waters, you get to know all this stuff about your future and that. But if you do that, then you become part of servitude to Mimir. So Blitzen and Hearth are in servitude to Mimir for different reasons, and they kind of work with him, and they were sent to protect Magnus because Mimir felt he needed protection. Just to throw that out there before I forget, because there's so many little intricate details and big, like, random characters that come up within the story. So does anyone else have feelings about Hearth and Blitzen?
I was just glad they stuck around as long as they did, because when, you know, Magnus is taken away and then all of a sudden you have them fall through the tree in his bedroom, I was like, all right, good. good. These guys are around for the long haul. And then we really got into, like, especially with, like, Blitzen, we got into so much of his backstory, and everything is so intricate, and I wasn't expecting it, but I really liked it, like, when they have that competition, and, you know, he's, like, it's just really, really interesting, the world that was built around that one character that I thought was going to go away after the first couple chapters.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot. I think that's something that Rick Riordan does really well, is that when you have a character that's interesting, there's a lot of layers, not just to the main character, but to all the characters that surround him. No one is taken at face value. There's much more to them than what they seem. So it's always a really cool thing when an author can do that at such a level with so many characters. And so we didn't really get to talk about Valhalla a little bit, but you did bring up the tree. So essentially, Magnus goes to Valhalla, and Valhalla is the afterlife for heroes. And what happens at Valhalla is it's basically this massive hotel that's part of the Nine Realms, and you stay there until Ragnarok. And part of what you do is you train for Ragnarok to fight. And there are two different, basically, in Norse mythology, there are, like, two camps. There are the Vanir, who have very specific gods that are a part of that group. And then there are the Aesir, I think is how you say it. And there are specific gods that belong to that group. Technically, Magus' father belongs to the Vanir, but he is, and they have a different afterlife called Folkvagnir. And I'm probably saying that completely wrong, so work with me. But he was brought to Valhalla instead. And so every day at Valhalla, they fight, and they learn how to fight. And you can die repeatedly at Valhalla, by the way. And you're resurrected within hours, and you heal, and you come back, and you basically do it all over again. And it's always in preparation for the next fight. At Folkvagnir, which we see later on, Folkvagnir is basically run by Magnus,
Freya?
Yeah, Magnus's aunt Freya, because Magnus's father is Frey, and they're very peaceful, nature-loving kind of people. Freya is super interesting when we meet her, and we discover when we meet Freya that Freya is actually Blitzen's mother, and so Blitzen and Magnus are cousins, which I thought was really interesting. So there are a lot of things that go on. So just so you have a little bit more backstory about these two places. So in Valhalla, Magnus has this room that's massive, and it's got all these really cool things in it. And within his room is basically an atrium with a lawn and a big tree in it. And that is how Blitzen and Harth find him, as they come crawling down the tree. So it was pretty cool. And Magnus lives on the 19th floor in Valhalla. And within that floor, we also meet some other characters who come back and play a little bit of a role later on in the story. And that's Mallory Keane, who is Scottish. Thomas Jefferson Jr., who was a Civil War fighter. Somebody named Halfborn, who is like an original berserker Viking. And then X, who is half troll. And all of these people are people that... or not all of them. I should say X is another person that Sam has brought in as a Valkyrie. And Sam is very much judged on the fact that she brought a half-troll into Valhalla. So,
jokes on everybody else.
Oh, yeah, because that does come up later, and X is rather much more important than what one thinks. So what do you guys think about kind of how Valhalla is laid out and the characters that we meet within Valhalla?
I love the 19th floor crew. Okay, so as soon as you meet TJ and Mallory and Halfborn, like, I got that camaraderie thing that you feel when you read Percy books, like they're all in it together and you believe them. And Magnus is brand new, and TJ like puts his, you know, I can kind of like picture him putting his arm around his shoulders and being like, you know, we'll help you out, no big deal. And he just kind of steers him through his first day and a half at Valhalla. And I love that about the Percy books. Like, I love that they work together as a team more often than anything else. And seeing the beginning of this book with Blitz and Hearth, like, I was kind of afraid that it was going to end up being Magnus meets these people and works with these people, and then he has to float over here. So as soon as he got to Valhalla and met these 19th floor crazy people, I was so excited because they run into battle together and they're taking hills, which was one of my favorite parts. And it's just, I got that camaraderie that I love so much about Riordan's books. And I hope and pray that these four, at least three or four, are going to play a greater role later on in the series, because I want to see more, definitely more from TJ and Mallory and Halfborn as well. So yeah, I really love these guys.
I miss X. I wish X wasn't Odin, because
I know.
I wanted X to stay.
I know.
Yeah, so Karen just gave it to you there. So in the end of the book...
Name drop.
Let me just throw that out there a little bit. At the end of the novel, because Odin has not been seen in Valhalla for 2 years. And so at the end of the book, we discover that Odin has been playing the role of X, and he basically wanted to come in and be, like, basically an undercover. Have you guys ever seen, like, Undercover Boss? Where the boss... I'm not even kidding. I know, this sounds really weird.
Oh, my God. That is perfect.
Thank
it's
you.
It's true, though. He's infiltrated their ranks and is watching them as one of them.
Right.
So that
to see they how don't they would treat him. Somebody different. And yeah. This is what he does to see what it'll look like. And so all along, every time Sam brings somebody in or something happens, Odin sees it firsthand, how the Thanes, who basically run Valhalla when Odin isn't present, how all of these things happen. And so I think it was great that Odin was there all along. And so it also means that when we get later into the story, that when they have to go to essentially... This whole quest of Magnus's is to go to the Island of Heather, and I think it had a different name, but I can't remember it right now. And he has to deal with Fenris Wolf. And Fenris is a son of Loki, and he has to deal with him, because once Fenris is set loose, he will be the beginning of Ragnarok. He's like the sign of the apocalypse, if you will. And so Magnus has to go out there and deal with this. And when they're dealing with Fenris, there are the 19th floor crew is there, including X, as well as a couple of other Valkyrie. And when they're there, Fenris knows that someone else is there and that they're hiding. And later on, we realize that it's Odin that is there on the island, but he's in the form of something else. So Fenris can sense that it's Odin, but he doesn't reveal to anyone that it's Odin, which was kind of cool. So I was wondering if someone was, like, hiding in the bushes somewhere, and then later on we find out that Odin was just in a different form. So a couple of other big things that happened to Magnus that we didn't really talk about, because I feel like there's so much to talk about, and we want to talk about absolutely everything in this novel, which means this podcast will be, like, 5 hours long. So let's read it in. But initially when Magnus goes to Valhalla, basically, your future is told, and a seer comes. It's offered up that Odin can come and tell your future, or the seer will read the runes and tell you what your future is. Well, when it becomes Magnus's turn to have his future told, the Norns themselves come. And basically, the Norns in Norse mythology are the sisters of fate in Greek mythology, if that makes sense. I think that's an equal comparison. So... they come, and the Norns never come, first of all. So the fact that the Norns come to tell Magnus his future is disturbing and unsettling to all. And that kind of transpires from there, and things kind of move forward from there. And Odin all along is there witnessing this to see how the Thanes respond, to see how the other Valkyries respond. And unfortunately, what happens is Sam gets booted out of the Valkyries for bringing Magnus to Valhalla, which is an important plot point we did not bring up as of yet. So we kind of go from there. Like, I don't know. There's so much to talk about. Do you guys have one thing that you think is super important that we haven't talked about that we should be talking about? because I don't know where to go next. There's just so much.
I feel like it's like episodic television. I'm like, well, I want to talk about the episode where they went to go and, like, you know, get some stuff. They went fishing with a bull's head. And then, no, I want to talk about when they met Thor. And then I'm like, no, I really actually just want to talk about the fact that Loki wears a Boston Red Sox jersey. Like, there's just like so much to talk about. And I was thinking about that while I was reading it. I'm like, how are we going to do this? Because it's just so much, which I think I liked, because you're never bored at any one moment, because you're like, okay, we're on to the next person. And then, oh, but Loki's back. And like, it was just, it's crazy.
The plot is relentless. Like, it's just one thing after another, which I think is really good to keep you enthralled in the story. But yeah, it's a lot to take in. A character I'd like to talk about is Gunilla, who was the leader of the Valkyries, because she was a pain in the ass for like 90% of the book.
She made Karen swear that's how big of a pain in the ass she was, just to be clear.
Thanks. Thanks so much. But she really was. I mean, she kept going after them and thinking that Magnus was just a mistake and that Sam was a mistake and she never should have been part of the Valkyries and all this other stuff. But then by the end, she sort of sacrifices herself so that Magnus can do what needs to be done. And that part was so tragic when it ended. I think the chapter ended on Surt. Like, was it Surt? No. It was somebody else.
Yes, it was Surt. It was Surt.
Just bringing his weapon down on her, and it was just like a fade to black moment. And I was like, oh, that hurt a lot more than I thought it was going to.
Yeah, I think Gunilla was really prejudiced against Samira and against anyone that she brought in, because Gunilla is the daughter of Thor and Sam is the daughter of Loki. Are they really ever going to be friends? Probably not. I mean,
Percy and Annabeth got along just fine.
Yeah, but this is different in a lot of ways, I think. So the problem is that you don't like her because she's so terrible and she sets them up in a lot of ways and she's cruel. But in the end, she does what's best for the world as a whole. Do you know what I mean? She knows that even though she doesn't necessarily agree with the plan, or she doesn't necessarily trust them, that they're the better option than what could happen. So she kind of gives them that leeway, I guess, in a sense. And it costs her life. And that's a very heavy thing. And I think that was one of those moments in the book that you don't expect necessarily. You know, and that's why I think it's also a little bit more young adult than middle grade, because of the way it plays out in a lot of ways. So
yeah, she's a tricky character because she's very unlikable, but she's not a bad guy. She's a good guy. She's one of the best guys. And just because you don't like her or don't agree with her doesn't mean that in the end she's not going to stand up for what is right and, you know, fight to the death, to her own death, for the world. And I think that's why it was so borderline for me until the very end. Like, I just kept going, man, I wish she would just go away. And then when she went away, I was like, oh, now I regret that.
You're like, I didn't want you to go away that far.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know. I think she's a super interesting character, and I like the role that she played. I think she was a good kind of foil, in a sense, to our other characters, because she is good, and she does mean well. But her prejudice get in the way of what can be accomplished because of those prejudices in a lot of ways, it ends up costing her her life. Because had she not been chasing down Magnus and Sam because she thinks that they're bad, she would have never been there. Do you know what I mean? Or she may have been there in a different capacity and more prepared for the things that were going to be happening than she was.
I also, kind of along the same lines, I loved that you had two different, like, forces trying to force Magnus away from the island. You had Gunilla telling him that Sam was going to lead him to the island and that she was working for Loki and that she was evil and blah, 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 and didn't want him there. And then you also had Loki, who's trying to tell him not to go, you know, is trying to lure him away from the island because he knows if he gets there and actually is successful, defeating Surt and re-establishing Fenris's, like, restrained. Yeah, thank you. Like they, you had these two forces that are basically on opposite sides, and they're both telling him to do the same thing. And Magnus makes his own decision and decides to go no matter what. Like, he was kind of on that, like, it's not a damned if you do, damned if you don't. It's like, well, I have one path now, because they, you know, both sides, good and bad, want me to do the same thing, and it doesn't feel right. Like, I loved that nice little plot. It's kind of a theme kind of worked in there, and you didn't, it didn't stand out. It's not something that, like, jumps out of you, but it's, you know, as we went step by step, and he talks to Loki in his dreams, and Gunilla keeps appearing, like, I really liked how he weaved that in there.
Yeah, it was very cool. And then I guess we do need to talk about Loki a little bit, because we didn't really. And then we do really need to talk about Thor. But Loki in this is your typical silver-tongued Loki. He is very much trying to manipulate to get what he wants. And although it is highly unclear what it is that Loki wants. Because in Norse mythology, your future is set. And you know what will happen to you. So all of the Norse gods and all of those in Valhalla and Folkvagnr know that Ragnarok is coming. No matter what, it's coming. You cannot stop Ragnarok. It's been predicted by the fates, by the Norns. So it's a matter of not knowing when it's coming and not knowing what it'll actually entail for people. That's the tricky part. And so as you, like, they're all very settled in the fact that these things will happen. And so one of the things that will happen is Frey, who is Magnus's father, he will be slain during Ragnarok by Surt using his own sword. So Frey's sword is Summerbalder, which is now in the possession of Magnus. So at some point in time, Magnus will have to lose the Sword of Summer, which is also known as Jack, by the way. Not to be confusing. It has three names. So at some point, Magnus will lose the sword. That sword will be used to kill his father. We cannot change those events. Those events are like fixed points. Like if you guys watch Doctor Who, there's a fixed point in time. These are fixed points. They cannot be changed. And so everyone was afraid that by Magnus going to the island, that he would set Ragnarok into kind of motion very early. Because Fenris will be freed and Ragnarok will begin. So there's this whole kind of level of mythology that's really kind of deep and complicated. And so there's a lot of things like that that play into, I think, as well, that are really interesting. And Loki, being Loki, is very, he's very convincing and charming. But Loki is also currently tied up in a dungeon having poison dripped on him, like, daily. So Loki's kind of out of the picture, yet he's still strong enough that he can manipulate people's dreams and visit them in their dreams and plant ideas in their head. So it was really interesting to see this Loki and what he could do and how he kind of approached things. On the contrary, then we had Thor. And this Thor, now mind you, I've seen all the Marvel movies. I know Chris Hemsworth is Thor. And so he automatically kind of pops up as you're reading, but that slowly fades when you start to, like, read what Thor is actually saying. I don't know how you guys felt about him, but Thor is kind of an idiot in this book. Like, point blank, he is not very bright. He's all the muscles, none of the brain. And it's really interesting to kind of see this Thor and what he's really like, and you're like, oh my god. And Thor, in this particular novel, also is not very good at keeping a hold of his weapons, is all I'm going to say. And I think what's also really interesting is in like the Marvel movies, if you guys have watched those, I'm not really sure if this is true to mythology or not, or if it's just true to like comic book Thor, but Mjolnir, which is his hammer, is only supposed to be allowed to be picked up by those who are worthy. So any of you who saw Age of Ultron, you know how that plays out. But in this set of novels, somehow Thor misplaces Mjolnir. And I'm still confused by that. So go ahead and discuss Loki and Thor being really ridiculous with his weapons.
Oh, God. Thor. Thor. He's arrogant, but in a sort of endearing kind of way. It's hard to explain because I still liked him even though he's an idiot. And I just really enjoyed how much he loved watching television and how he was like a huge Game of Thrones fan. That is just very Rick Riordan. And the fact that he threw in, like we were saying, those modern references, I was just like, of course he would like Game of Thrones. That is exactly the sort of thing that he would like.
And the dwarves are responsible for Taylor Swift was my favorite little modern day reference. They're like, what do you mean Thor music?
And Thor's sheep. I mean, let's just aim it for 5 seconds. Ridiculous. Like Yeah, like they die all the. They're like, it's okay, you can just kill us. And I'm like, what? And because I am not very familiar with Norse mythology, so every bit of this was surprising to me. And that whole sequence with Thor and the sheep, and oh god, it just got me. It was a nice little moment, especially with all the intensity of the competition with dwarves that had happened right before it and all of that. But yeah, no, hysterical.
I loved when Harth was like, this guy's an idiot. And then Thor would be like, yes, I know I'm amazing. It was so funny.
Yes, because, yeah, he just doesn't get sign language. It's pretty awesome. Yeah, the goats were, like, funny, but also disturbing. Like, so the goats were basically, again, they could be resurrected. So you would kill them, like, dismember them, eat them. And then they would be back the next day, and it was just so weird. And, like, Otis the goat was, like, fantastic, I'm not gonna lie. He's, like, neurotic and crazy, and I loved every minute of it. So, but again, really weird that you would kill them, eat them, and then it would, like, it would he'd be alive the next day. It was just weird.
Yeah, no, I think weird's the only way you describe it, but memorable, it's definitely memorable. It's not something you're gonna forget anytime soon.
And I love how he talked about immersion therapy. That the goat had to have therapy. Oh my god, you guys, I was dying. It was amazing. All right, so this is getting to be a very lengthy podcast, so let's get on to the relationships, because I think this is a really cool point. Karen, you did get to interview Rick about Magnus, and so tell us a little bit about the love interest aspect, because if you guys noticed, Magnus didn't really have a love interest in this story, which is kind of unusual in a lot of ways, but at the same time, really cool. So what did he have to say about that, Karen?
Yeah, this was like the first thing that I noticed, really, because it was clear pretty early on that Sam was off limits. And I was like, is there going to be like a love triangle thing? Because I'm not sure I'm into that. And then you realize by the end of the book, no, like there's just nothing between them. Like they're friends and that's good enough for them. It was like Magnus didn't even have anybody to look to as a possible love interest. So it was one of the first things I asked him. And he said, quote, it was intentional. It came from the interplay between the characters. Obviously, Sam being who she is, that's not an option. You're just not going to see that with her. She's not that kind of girl. Whether there will be romance in the later books, I don't know how that will play out. End quote. Which is really interesting, not only for a middle grade young adult book, which almost always has some sort of romantic point in it, but even his books, like Percy and Annabeth are the biggest ship, and it's been so prominent throughout all of the books, all 10 of the books that they're in, and a driving force in a lot of ways. To see Magnus without any love interest in the first book was really interesting, and I really want to know why he did that. I mean, I know he said there was just no option, really. But I wonder if he's planting the seeds for something else down the line and he just wants to make us wait, or if it's just not that big of a deal for Magnus.
I think part of it is when you're a homeless kid, things are very different. Your priorities are different. You don't have your basic needs met. Like you don't have a home. You don't have a place to stay warm. You don't know when your next meal is coming. You don't have showers and stuff. So I wonder if that played into it as well. And now maybe once we see more of his needs being met, that need of love and affection will come later.
That's a great point. I didn't even think about that.
That is my psychological viewpoint. So, yeah, so I don't know, but I think it is really interesting, and it would be interesting to see kind of how it plays out in the end, I guess. There's a lot of different things, I guess, that different ways that this story could go for Magnus, so I would be curious to see how it plays out. So, do you guys have anything else that you want to bring up while we're on the topic of Magnus Chase? I mean, like we said, there's so many details and so much to talk about. Yes, this is the abbreviated version of our love for this book. So, Karen, I'm going to make you go first.
Okay, don't judge me on this, but I ship Hearth and Blitz like hardcore. I don't know if anyone else got that vibe, but from the very beginning when Magnus was like, they're like my parents, one's my mom and one's my dad, and I was like, okay, is there something else supposed to be going on here? But I really, really liked their relationship, whatever it is, their friendship. For two different creatures that are kind of opposites of each other to come together and be as close as they are, I think was really nice on a lot of different levels. I mean, you know, we've been talking about prejudice and all this other stuff, and the fact that they could be friends as close as they are was huge. But I love Hearth and Blitz, and I hope that they're in the second book, and maybe we find out if there's something more between them.
Okay. I love Hearth and Blitz, too. They're really fun. And I love that Blitz gave Hearth, like, the candy cane scarf, and he wears it all the time, even if it doesn't match the rest of his outfits. Anyway, Kristen, how about you? What was one of your favorite moments?
Okay, I have two. One is the battle in Valhalla when they're, like, taking the hill, because I just love the thing that Mallory says about he likes to take hills. And so you've got this little introduction to TJ and Mallory and Gunderson, and like, it was just such a really fun, ridiculous moment. And it's also the first moment that we see Magnus use magic. Like, you see the kind of power Magnus has. And it just kind of like got me primed for what eventually would happen, like what else was going to happen in this book. And my other favorite bit was, I'm going to murder this name, Yggdrasil. And the, like, the story of the forces at the bottom, the dragon, I think it was, and the force at the top of the tree that are both trying to destroy it, and the squirrel that's running between them. Like,
the crazy squirrel, yes!
Yeah, like, I loved all of that. Like, I, again, don't know much about Norse mythology, but I found that all really, really intriguing. Like, that rather than this tree, you know, thriving and everything works in a balance, the forces at the top and bottom of the tree are trying to destroy it, and the squirrel is keeping them in battle. Like, it's just such a cool idea, and I just really enjoyed that whole bit of the story, too.
The squirrel is the biggest pot stirrer ever.
Basically, yeah, that's his job. It's just to keep the tension going.
All right, Brittany, how about you?
I think my favorite part, and this is, like, the weirdest part of the book to like, because it's sort of like one of those, like, proclamation-y endings, but I think that Rick Riordan, like, kind of put his own spin on it. Like, you know how Dumbledore comes in at the end of every Harry Potter book, he's like, exams are canceled, and, like, you know, here's kind of what I've been up to, Harry, just so you have, like, you know, the gist of me trying to kill myself to save you guys. But Odin does it, like, in a way where he's like, gives, like, this, like, high and mighty, like, I'm Odin speech, like, you know, tells a few jokes, like, how he waited in line for a smartphone in a blizzard for 6 days, because he wanted, like, all the knowledge of the world, and I just really love that whole scene. It's sort of like, it's like a slideshow presentation, and it's sort of like the wizard presenting, like, you know, each person with a gift, but also kind of Dumbledore, like, you know, explaining, like, what the state of the world is. So I love that whole scene, and I hope Odin's around for a lot more, because I think he's kind of great.
I agree. This, or at the end, when Odin's like, I'm going to show you my slideshow presentation, and like, or you're so lucky, I'm going to teach you runestones, and you'll get a copy of my signed book and DVD. Like,
and it's like, you can pick it up in the gift shop on your way out.
There's a little bit of, like, you know, a salesman in Mr. Odin, and I do agree. I think that was a lot of fun. I really liked a lot of the stuff with Jack the Sword, and how Magnus had to be kind to the sword, and he had to kind of, like, embrace the sword in order to be able to use its powers. Because the sword is not just a sword. the sword has all this power and all of this stuff. And what happens is Magnus is not very nice to the sword at first. And so he has to, like, start to talk to the sword and start to, like, befriend the sword and make the sword feel better. And as soon as he kind of gives the sword an ego boost, you know, it comes alive and it actually talks. It's a talking sword. This is not a joke. And I thought that was one of the best parts about it is when you have this kind of wild and crazy sword who knows he's going to become bad. He knows he's supposed to go to Surt and feels the pull to go to Surt, but Magnus still manages to maintain and keep him. And then for me, one of the best parts was at the end when Magnus goes to see Frey, who's his father, and Jack is with him, and Jack is like, dude, the bro code. And he's, like, going on about swords before whatever, and, like, it
blades
was just...
Blades before babes.
That's what it was. Like, I was dying. Like, it was... The sword is its very own character, and he is phenomenal. But, yeah, he was, like, just went on. He's like, you traded me for you know, a giantess's hand in marriage, man. What is wrong with you? And so, like, he's a little bitter. Jack's a little bitter with Frey. He's like, your kid's okay, though. So I think those moments were really funny because, like, Jack is around when there are really serious moments, but Jack is not serious in any way, shape, or form. Like, so I love that fact about him, and I really enjoyed that, like, aspect of the character of the actual sword. Like, you don't get too many inanimate objects that get their own, like, voice and stuff. So I thought that was really cool. And, I don't know, I like so much of the book, it's hard to really pinpoint. But I think you guys brought up a lot of good points about the things you discussed. And then at the very end, when we kind of get a glimpse into the future with Loki and Randall. And Randall is Magnus's uncle, who is clearly not okay. And Loki, again, we kind of get a little bit of a look at his plan. We still don't know what his real plan is, but you get a better look at it. And we get kind of a hint because the next book is called The Hammer of Thor. And we kind of figure out maybe where Thor's hammer is actually located. So it was really interesting. So I don't know. So many good things to say about this book. So many, like, really fun, exciting things happening. You should definitely read it. You don't have to have read any of the Percy Jackson books. Not, you know, don't tell Karen you didn't, but you don't have to have read them. To read this book, it's completely separate. I mean, you won't know the backstory of Annabeth, but that's okay. You don't necessarily have to have the backstory of Annabeth. You'll just miss the inside joke about why she's like, no, Magnus, I know your life is strange and weird things are happening, but I think I can help you with that. And Magnus is like, no, cousin, I don't want to bring you into this. And she's like, no, cousin, I think it's okay. and I like that moment at the end too, with Magnus and Annabeth and how she's like, no, seriously, you can tell me it's okay. So yeah, so I don't know. There's so many great things in this book and I really, really enjoyed it. And it's a super fast read. Like, once you get started on it, it's really hard to put down because there's just, like Karen said, this plot starts and it does not stop until the last page. And it is constant. And there are lots of little twists and turns here and there. You never know. Like, predicting what's going to happen next in the story is really hard. I don't know how Rick Riordan writes or how his mind works, but it is intense, is all I'm going to say. So, do you guys have any last thoughts on Magnus Chase?
Well, I'd like to know, Brittany, and I'm asking this honestly, not being obnoxious, like, does this make you interested in reading Percy Jackson? Or are you like, well, maybe not now that you've got a taste of what Rick Riordan's writing is like?
I wouldn't say that it turned me off of Percy Jackson, but I think I want to read this series first. Even though I have to wait for this series to happen, I kind of want to, like, stick in one world and not go back and get tired of Rick Riordan if that mm-hmm. does happen. So, and I really liked this book, so I think I want to just stick with this and then maybe go back and read Percy Jackson. And it actually works out perfectly because my nephew's kind of at the perfect age to, like, maybe once we're by, like, book 3 in this series, like, he can start reading Percy Jackson. So, you know, we'll see.
Cool. We'll see. And then we have Trials of Apollo to look forward to. So yeah, many more Percy books.
I'm definitely not opposed to going back and reading them, but I think I am a little nervous after reading one of them, getting tired of the humor, especially since you explained it, because I didn't know that, you know, like these are, I mean, I did know that they were written for a younger audience, but knowing that about Percy Jackson, like how it's an even younger target audience, I might just stick with this series for right now.
Yeah, and but that's like totally it. Fair.
Listeners, of course, I'm sure you have lots of strong feelings about Magnus Chase, as we did. So please make sure to leave comments, questions, concerns. Feel free to hit up Karen on Twitter. She loves to talk about Percy. Percy and Magnus. Sorry, and Magnus. Uh-huh. So I think our verdict is definitely this is a book to check out and read. Pass it along. Have everyone you know read it, because it's fantastic. And it's great because it represents a large population. It's diverse. Anyone can be a hero. And I love that message. I think it's got a lot to offer. So until next time, I'm Jen.
I'm Brittany.
I'm Karen.
And I'm